MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's Tuesday afternoon, and each and every Tuesday afternoon, we have a chat and catch up with Dr. Ross Walker. He's on the phone this afternoon. Hello, Ross.
Is it that time again, Tuesday?
It's come
around so quickly.
It comes around very, very
quickly. Seems like it was only a week ago we were talking.
It seems that way, doesn't it? It was.
Yes. Yeah.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, mate. How are you going?
I can't complain, mate. Can't get rid of the damn cough. It's 5 weeks now.
Yeah, unfortunately, whether it's COVID or whether it's influenza, this thing can still cause chronic inflammation. See, people have been so COVID-focused that we've taken the emphasis off things like influenza. There's another thing going around called respiratory syncytial virus, and all of these things can inflame the lungs. They're bad respiratory tract infections, and they can do this. And unfortunately, it does take a while. But it is important, if anyone's listening, and this is for you as well, my friend, if you do have a chronic cough, someone needs to listen to your lungs to make sure there's no evidence of wheezing, because it could be an asthmatic-like effect from the infection that can be specifically treated, and then all the symptoms will go away.
Okay, I've got an email that I sent you earlier in the week. Dr.
Yep.
Grundy has produced, this is from Jeff. Jeff wants to say that Dr. Grundy has produced a gut health pill with ingredients that delivers the contents into the gut dissolving. And the main ingredients are prebiotics and probiotics, supposed to repair the gut wall to eliminate leaky bowel problems. Could you please comment on the capsules, he said?
Yeah, and they're actually also what we call postbiotics, which are the metabolites of gut bacteria. So the prebiotics are the food that the bacteria eat. So soluble fibres, insoluble fibres are all chewed up by the gut bacteria, not so much the insoluble ones, but the soluble ones are chewed up by the gut bacteria, and as are things like onion and garlic, have a lot of soluble fibre in it, and the good bacteria love those. And then you've got the probiotics, which are the actual bacteria themselves, but the healthy bacteria make these things called short-chain fatty acids, which are things like butyric acid. That's one of the common ones, and all of these different short-chain fatty acids have a profound effect on health. So there's a really nasty thing called TMAO, which is produced by a pathogenic gut bacteria that can actually increase the fat buildup in your arteries. Other pathogenic bacteria can make a thing called alpha-synuclein that can travel up what we call the vagus nerve into the brain and increase your risk for Parkinson's disease. So having good gut health is really important. Scott Gundry is actually a cardiologist who's now gone into the field of gut health, and he's trying to sell these pretty expensive supplements made in America, and they may be highly effective. I'm not denigrating what he's doing, but the problem is they are American supplements, and American supplements are often made to food standard, not to the pharmaceutical grade that we get with Australian supplements. And I just can't sit here and say how good they are, because I don't know.
Right.
But what I do know is that a lot of the stuff that he's selling can be obtained in Australia from an Australian pharmaceutical grade having the same effect. So I would research what he's flogging and try to see if you can source those products in Australia, because A, they'll be a lot cheaper, and B, they'll be made to a better standard than the typical American grade supplements. Some of them are great, and Scott's stuff may be superb. I just don't know enough about it to endorse it or to denigrate it.
For people listening to us this afternoon who may want to improve their gut health, what's the simple things that people can do?
Well, the first thing is to eat proper food. You see, the thing is, so many people are eating this processed packaged crap masquerading as food that they get in a box. So keep away from the centre bits of a supermarket. Only shop in the outside bits that are selling the fruits and vegetables. So people who have two or three pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, and tragically that's less than 10% of people, have the healthiest guts on the planet. So that's the first thing. Secondly, a good hint I give people is if you can get it, use A2 milk. Now, A2 milk is more expensive than A1 milk or standard milk in Australia, which is 60% A2, 40% A1. But pure A2 milk tends to have a better effect on gut health. And some people who have really bad gut problems can look at things like the low FODMAP diets. There's a Professor Sue Shepherd who's developed all these low FODMAP diets. She's a dietitian in Victoria, and so her low FODMAP diets are good for some people with gut disorders. But then we've mentioned the tribiotics, whether it's a good prebiotic, a probiotic or a postbiotic can also help gut health as well. And you see, one of the problems is over the last 20, 30 years, because of increasing cesarean rates. Now, this might sound weird, but babies born by cesarean have totally different gut health to babies that have been born naturally. And the reason being is they don't come down the birth canal where they get exposed to all these natural bacteria. And that's a good way to start your life, with good healthy bacteria coating the body and coating the gut. And it's also that kids that have had a lot of antibiotics as children have wiped out their healthy bacteria as well. So it's good nutrition. Strangely, exercise can help gut health. Taking a combination of these tribiotics, or at least a prebiotic and probiotic as you get older. And that's really the best way to keep your gut healthy.
Okay. Now, the world's first study of the impact of childhood fitness and obesity on cognition in middle age. Yep. It followed over 1,200 people. These 1,200 people were kids in 1985, and they were followed for over 30 years. And it's found that better performance on physical tests is related to better cognition later in life. Simple, isn't it? Makes sense.
This is the thing, really getting back to what we were just saying then about gut health as well. Really, our health throughout our life goes from pre-cradle to grave. And in fact, the health of our parents when they're conceiving. And this is the problem for young people. A lot of young people just treat their bodies how they feel like. People in their 20s often think they're bulletproof, so just do whatever they like to their body. And they don't realize that if you are under enormous stress, if you're smoking, if you're eating crappy food, even in the couple of months before you get pregnant, and it's the same applies to the male component of this discussion, that you can then induce factors that can impact on your unborn child for the rest of their days. And we know that there are factors in utero, so low birth weight babies, babies who don't double their birth weight in the first 12 months of life, babies who are breastfed beyond 12 months have more cardiovascular disease 40, 50 years later. That's been done in a thing called the Hartford Heart Study. And this study out of Monash University in Melbourne, published in the Journal of Science and Sport and Medicine in Sport, looked at 1,244 people born in 1985, followed for 30 years, and showed clearly that in childhood, if they were obese and they lacked fitness, that they had much worse cognition, thinking skills, much less processing speed and attention span as middle-aged people. And there's been many studies showing a link between those factors and dementia later in life. So it's really interesting to think that how we allow our children to behave, how they live, the little obese kids we see walking around, the kids who aren't playing sport, that can have a significant effect on their how they think in middle age and therefore their risk for dementia as they get older. It's really quite profound stuff.
Well, I was going to say, does that mean that people like you and I, our mums, you know, there was not anywhere near the amount of junk food that was that's available today that was around when, you know, your mum and my mum was pregnant with us, number one. Number two, I mean, you and I are of the age where after school we'd go out in the park and play cricket. There was no such thing as a computer screen.
No, exactly. And in fact, it's interesting that they've done studies to show that average children these days are spending more than 4 hours a day in front of a screen and less than an hour a day playing outside. And there is no doubt that playing outside, getting a bit of dirt on you, there's a thing, if people might not have heard of this concept before, there's a thing called dirt. and you're allowed to get dirt on your knees and graze your knees a bit. And in fact, studies have shown that there's all these different bacteria in dirt that enhance the immune response, make your immune system so much healthier. So it's not just the exercise, but it's exposure to nature is so good for everyone's health, not just a child's health, but for adults' health as well. So I think we really have to rethink how we're living. These helicopter parents that won't let their kids fall over. And you remember when we were kids, Brent, the playgrounds had the concrete at the bottom of the slippery dip, or the concrete under the monkey bars, and you fall and you scratch yourself on the concrete. But these days, there's this sort of this rubber, so the children can't hurt themselves. And it's just, I don't know, I think society's gone nuts.
So you wrote an article on Alzheimer's disease. Can it be prevented? Can I ask you this question?
Sure.
In the score of 1 to 5, dementia, Alzheimer's, where does that rate in reference to killing people in Australia? Is it 2? Is it number 3?
I think dementia is probably, worldwide, it's about the 7th leading cause of death. There's close to 500 million people affected by dementia in varying degrees, from mild cognitive impairment up to full-blown dementia. And I think it's probably about the 3rd or 4th leading cause of death. I think it's the 2nd leading cause of death for women after cardiovascular disease. Cancer's pretty close in there as well. So it's a really, really big issue. And the point is, it's like anything in medicine. We have the ambulance parked at the bottom of the cliff waiting for people to fall off. So instead of fixing the rails at the top, i.e. prevention, what do? We build faster ambulances. So I think the thing to do with dementia is to nip it in the bud very early by things like we're talking about today. Get children to exercise, stop them from being obese, stop them eating crappy food. But also as we get older, there's what I call my 5 keys to mental sharpness over the age of 70. One is to keep working. I heard a statistic the other day, only 14% of people over the age of 65 are in active employment. And I see that Peter Dutton's now come out and saying that he's trying to make it easier for pensioners to be able to get back into the workforce. But again, they were in charge for nine years. They should have maybe thought of it back then. But I agree entirely. Encourage people to keep working because it's so good for the brain. At least if you're not working, keep your interest in your employment. So I have a physician who comes to my office a few times a week who's in his 80s, and he comes and he just sits in to maintain his medical registration. He sits in and just listens. He was one of my teachers when I was in my 20s, and I'm giving back now because he comes in and listens to me and sits there and keeps his brain engaged. So keep working. Number 2, use it or lose it. So basically, do crosswords, Sudokus, brain training, do new courses, learn new skills, play the guitar or play a musical instrument, be bilingual. All of those things keep the brain active and watered in all areas, and be open to change. One of the problems for all of us as we get older, we tend to do the same things with the same people in the same way, and we don't do different things, and people don't like doing different things. It's so good for your brain. Number 4, hang around with optimistic people. And number 5, be optimistic yourself. And those things are the factors or the features of people who maintain good brain activity over the age of 70. And there's a study called a fellow called Dale Bresden who runs an Alzheimer's reversal clinic in Southern California, where he's used a combination of lifestyle change, all the things we talk about all the time, brain training, different nutraceuticals, the certain supplements that we've discussed many times over the years, and also direct cranial stimulation, which is a little pad that sits over your brain and sends electromagnetic pulses into the brain. And he's actually reversed Alzheimer's disease in a small study in 10 out of 11 people. The only person who wasn't reversed is somebody who had end-stage Alzheimer's disease far too late.
Can I just go back on those 5? So it was keep working. In other words, keep an interest. Number 2, use it or lose it, right?
Yep.
Read the brain.
Yep.
Number 3, be open to change.
Yep.
Number 4, hang around optimistic people.
Yep.
And number 5, be optimistic yourself.
Absolutely.
Pretty simple and straightforward, isn't it?
Simple, simple and straightforward stuff, but so important.
Ross Ray has sent in an email, and he says, could you ask Dr. Walker this question? Is AFib a death sentence without medication? If not on medication, can AFib be kept under control with regular exercise and a sensible diet? Regards and thanks, Ray.
Yeah, look, atrial fibrillation is a very common condition that affects 1% of people up to age 50, 5% 60, 10% 70, 20% 80. If we all live to 150, and thank God we don't at the moment, if we all did, we'd all be in atrial fibrillation. Why? Because the specialised electrical tissue in the top of the heart wears out as we get older. And when it does, instead of the heart contracting normally, it just goes into this quivering rhythm we call atrial fibrillation. The problem is, in not treating it, is that if you don't treat it because the atrium's not contracting properly, little clots can form in the atrium, flick up to your brain and cause a stroke. So it's not a death sentence, but it is a risk not treating it. So I treat all of my patients with atrial fibrillation, especially when they get over 65. I put them all onto very strong blood thinners to stop the clots from forming, and I try to keep them in a good rhythm most of the time with different antiarrhythmic drugs to regulate the heartbeat. But also there's the possibility of ablation as well. So just good lifestyle and regular exercise, good diet, etc., is a good adjunct to treating atrial fibrillation. And there's no doubt that if people can lose weight, because it's the increasing obesity we're seeing in society, that fat infiltrates into the electrics and makes the electrics wear out more. So I've had some patients who's lost 10, 15, 20 kilos and their atrial fibrillation went away. But many people don't have the discipline to do that. But if people do have the discipline to do it, maintain a healthy exercise, maintain good eating. And I also, in that situation, like to throw in a bit of omega-3 and magnesium as well. But in almost all cases, we need to have the strong blood thinning and the antiarrhythmics or the ablation or both.
Can you feel AFib?
Some people do, some people don't. So there are, I'd say about a third of people wandering around with atrial fibrillation don't even know they've got it, but I've got other people who know as soon as they go into atrial fibrillation. So I saw a woman yesterday, for example. I see probably two or three patients a day with atrial fibrillation, but a woman yesterday who had gone into atrial fibrillation, and she had no idea. I hadn't seen her for 12 months, and she had no idea she was in atrial fibrillation. So I'm trying to get her back into a good rhythm, but I'm not particularly hopeful because the back chamber's so dilated, so big, that it doesn't look like we're going to be able to do it, but I'm giving it a try.
Okay, there you go, Ray. Vitamin K2. What is vitamin K2? What's it do for us?
Well, vitamin K is the blanket term for this fat-soluble vitamin that's very important in many body functions. So vitamin K1 especially, I'll get onto K2 in a second, but K1 is found in leafy green vegetables, and it's a really important component of blood clotting. Whereas vitamin K2 is more in dairy products, fermented foods, Japanese natto, which is where they get the K2 in proprietary form for capsules. Vitamin K2 affects more bone health, so it has an effect on that. And basically, I give vitamin K2 in a dose of 180 micrograms a day to all of my cardiac patients because it takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it back in your bones. So you get two bangs for your buck, you get more flexible arteries and stronger bones. But a recent study out of China looked at this nerve agent that damages nerves called 6-hydroxydopamine, and it causes degeneration in the dopamine nerves, which are really important in the generation of Parkinson's disease. So they used almost like an animal model of Parkinson's disease by giving this 6-hydroxydopamine to damage the nerves. And it found that if you gave vitamin K2, it actually blocks that effect. So what they're suggesting is that not only is vitamin K2 good for bone health and good for cardiac health, but it appears it may also be good for neurodegeneration in the brain. And the point is, it's a harmless thing to take. The dose I suggest is 180 micrograms a day. I take it myself just to keep my bones strong because my calcium score is zero. So I just do it purely just to keep my bones strong. But it's obviously a good thing to take. So vitamin K2 is a good, simple supplement that's not expensive, and it has all of these extra benefits.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. Our time is up again. It goes so quick on a Tuesday. We will catch up with you next Tuesday, all right?